Succession number 28897, Reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with George Oliver in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 24th of 3rd, 2006, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. George, I wanted us to discuss that period where you finished the first drop of paratroopers, and returning back to base, and the feeling of that return, having returned successfully.
Yes, well, we dropped the troops, and of course we were very relieved to think that we'd done that, and there was a bit of flak around, so we were on our toes, and I think I mentioned previously that I did see one Stirling crashing, and so we flew back to the UK. There wasn't a great deal of flak on the way out, so far as I can recall. But I was anxious to get out, and I think I might have been travelling a bit too fast because the boys had to wind in the static lines with this hand winch.
You were mentioning a bit of a joke about whether you might stay for a while.
Probably, but then I slowed down a bit, you see, and I don't know how fast I was. Al Stirling wasn't that fast, but really, but at any rate, we had an uneventful trip across the channel, and then I called up and asked permission to land at Keevil, and in we went and landed, and most of the squadron personnel were out on the tarmac there near the runway waiting for us to land, and there was much rejoicing and so forth when we got out of the aircraft. It reminded me a bit of a football grand final, and but one sobering effect, which I think I've mentioned before, was to see a parachute hanging on the propeller of or the air screw of a one of our aircraft. And I think I mentioned before that we lost one aircraft with all the troops and crew, with no survivors, had a few damaged, and the other squadron on the station, 299 squadron, they lost to Stirling in a similar manner. So that was our casualties for the night on the station.
What was that like? And you come back, and obviously you've been in a state of readiness, you've been keyed up, your adrenaline's going haywire to keep you in the air and to do your job. What's it like then to suddenly hit the ground?
Oh, relief would be the word, I think. You know, it's really great. I've seen blokes bend down and kiss the ground. Yes, and you felt like that a bit. And, of course, then we went off and had a meal, and then hopped into bed for the remainder of the night.
Was that possible, just to go to sleep after all this?
I think I did get to sleep eventually, and I remember thinking that it was nice to have that bit over, and we knew that there'd be something on in the morning. So, but it was probably a pretty scratchy sort of a sleep, I suppose. But at any rate, in the morning we got up and had our breakfast and went down to the flight office to read the battle orders, and we were on Operation Mallard. Now, Operation Mallard was a daylight exercise, a daylight operation, and it was to tow gliders filled with troops, mobile guns, jeeps, and all sorts of ammunition and stuff. And I think there were 200 or 300 aircraft involved in it. So we were briefed for it.
And how did you feel when, obviously given the brief, you're going to be doing this in daylight?
Yes, daylight. Well, it was an unknown experience again to tow gliders over there in daylight. And I think Ron and I were chatting away at one stage over the previous night and whatnot. And I think from my memory, we were apprehensive to some extent, but quite excited in a way too. We'd heard that the night drop had gone reasonably well from a military point of view. And we were just talking about that, waiting. After the briefing, we had to wait until we got the order to go to the aircraft and take it out onto the runway. So I think we would have gone out from memory about lunchtime or so, or just after lunch, to run up our engines and check our aircraft right out to make sure everything was spot on, and the crew would go too and check all their gear and so forth. And then it was just a matter of waiting until we got called to go down and pick up our parachutes and our flying gear and hop on the aircraft.
People discuss the waiting as the hardest part.
Yes, well, I think I mentioned before that I was so fidgety the day before that I went and had a shower and did myself up, and that captain or the officer in charge told me I looked as though I was going to a bloody dance. So I suppose we felt the same way then. Waiting was, yes, it was. You couldn't do anything, you just had to wait. So Ron and I were sitting there having a bit of a talk. Now, I remember that much. Mm. And we discussed some of our what we saw the night before. And I'm not sure now whether Ron mentioned the aircraft that was shot down that I saw or not, but at any rate, I mentioned that to him, I think, anyhow. Mm. But then eventually we got the call to go to the aircraft. So we went into the, and picked up our parachutes and goggles and helmets and gloves and everything that we wore. And I don't think I wore any. I had flying boots on that day. I remember that. But I don't think I had anything other than the uniform on. So we hopped into our aircraft and taxied it all onto the runway in some specific order. We would be waved with flags and things, you know, ground crew. Guiding us onto the into our particular positions, and we all lined up along the runway, and the gliders were there at an angle to the runway, and it was similar to what had been the night before. We taxied on, but of course this time we had to have a glider connected. So as I mentioned before, on the exercises, my procedure was to when I got the green light, taxi onto the runway, and when I got the red light, I stopped while they connected the glider, and when I got the amber light, I opened the engines up to full throttle with the brakes full on, and when I got the green light, I let the brakes off, and we tore down the runway with our glider, and our two squadrons did that. Possibly about 30 odd aircraft towing gliders from our squadron, I think. But I think there were 200 or 300 gliders. So
I understand from what Ron says that you had to sort of do a great big wide arch if you were in the front and wait for the others to catch up while they took off.
Yes, that's true. We did. We circled around until we were in more or less a gaggly old group, and then we had to navigate to a rendezvous point somewhere near the east coast, I think it was. I can't remember the name of the town below, but This rendezvous point was where we connected up with all the other squadrons. See, there were 10 squadrons in 38 Group, and I don't know whether the whole 10 squadrons took gliders over that night or not, but we rendezvoused there, and then at a given time we all set course for a place near Ranville in France. And previous to us going, on the night before, Major Frost, that's when Major Frost went over and landed a glider at the end of this particular bridge in near Ranville in France, which was a bridge across a canal. And he had other gliders with him, I'm not too sure. There might have been half a dozen of them, I think. And they were towed over, as I understand, from can't think of the name of the headquarters at any rate, but they were towed over by another squadron anyhow, and they'd captured this bridge. Well, they took the bridge, and they must have been getting into a fight, and some of them were wounded at any rate, and I've got a little story to tell you about that shortly. We flew across, towing the gliders. Of course, it was quite strenuous towing these things on a fairly long trip, but it was even more tiring for the glider pilots. They had to keep in the high tow position, and we had to try and keep out of slipstreams, because there were 200 or 300, I think, aircraft going with us, all towing gliders. And
I asked you before, when you were flying out to drop the paratroopers, what the view was like. What was the view like in daylight with all these planes towing gliders?
Well, it was magnificent, really. As far as you could see, there were gliders, glider combinations everywhere. It'd be front and behind. I must have been in the middle somewhere, I think, because wherever I looked, there they were, all going along in a gaggle, sort of a very loose formation, I suppose you might say. And which reminds me, too, it was daylight, and we were able to look down on the invasion fleet, which was had arrived in the morning following our night operation. And it was an amazing sight. I understand there were 5,000 vessels of one sort and another down there, from battleships to landing barges. And I can only say it by saying it was awesome. But these days they use awesome in pretty loose terms about all sorts of little things. But it was a magnificent sight, and a sight that will never be seen again because of the change in the way wars are run now. And also I understand there were about 5,000 aeroplanes as well operating, because there was bombing going on. And there were the fighter umbrellas over us, and probably photographic planes and all sorts of planes. And I understand there was about 5,000 aircraft and 5,000 vessels down on the... So you can imagine what it was like.
Well, what did it feel like to be a part of all of this? Here you are in a gaggle of...
Yeah.
But you can see everything below and everything above.
Yeah. Yes, what did it feel like? Well, I don't know. You see, you're so busy, you don't sort of think much about your feelings at the time. I suppose we were a bit nervous. But when you're actually flying, I always felt more nervous before I got on the aircraft than when I was actually flying it. And then there was so much of absorbing interest around you. You had to keep your eye on everything in case you ran into another aircraft or something like that. And
in looking back, it must be incredible to to know that you were part of this history-making event.
Yes. Yes, it was. I don't think it dawned on us at the time quite so much as afterwards, when it really became a massive, you know, it was really a big thing in military history, wasn't it? And
my mother remembers, as a young girl, seeing troops going south, literally all day, troops in covered trucks going south, and seeing the last blokes in the trucks sort of looking out and doing thumbs up to her as they drove past.
Yes.
They were going south for D-Day.
Yes, that's right. Well, there were 4 million Americans, I think, in Britain at the time, and there were lots of... And then the Canadians had soldiers there as well, airborne troops, and that I know of. They might have had more Canadian soldiers in the ground forces. I'm not sure about that, but we didn't have anyone like that because our boys out here were involved with the Japanese side by then, and that. Yes, it was a very impressive thing. There's no doubt about that.
You mentioned awesome.
Yes.
Awe-inspiring.
Awe-inspiring in the true sense of the word. It was awe-inspiring. And
Ron talks of the channel being sort of churned up into this white foam by all of these ships going across.
Yes. Oh, yes, they weren't all there. They were still going all the time, and there was the harbour, the Mulberry Harbour. We could see all that. And, there were... and then there were deception plans going on too. I don't know whether they were going on right through the day or not, but these people that were flying across, throwing window out and flying in rectangles and just moving along at the speed of a convoy.
You mentioned them doing that the night before.
Yeah. Whether they did that the next day or not, I'm not too certain, but...
You also mentioned a bit of flak. Just coming over the coast, what was the feeling like? Here we go, boys.
Well, when we see the flak, they were little puffs. You couldn't see them at night, of course, except the tracer and stuff and the explosions. But in daylight, they were little puffs of smoke everywhere, so you got an idea of how thick they were. You got an idea of where they were. You had some chance of sort of going around them a bit, but at any rate, we just tried to dodge them if we could, and we knew that flak was part of the game. You know, it wasn't any great surprise.
Other pilots that I've spoken to, bomber pilots, talk of it as the duck shoot, literally, jumping the fence.
Yeah.
And here you are, you're literally in a gaggle of geese by the sound of things.
Yes, that's right.
When you're coming up, what's going through your mind? Anything?
Oh, just concentrating on the dropping zone, really. Yes. I don't actually recall the exact dropping zone this time, but it was to reinforce these chaps who had captured the bridge. And... this bridge was vital. Apparently it went straight into wherever the fighting was going on up there. And they'd been in some fighting during the day. But at any rate, we dropped them. And I'll go back to that little story a bit later on. But we dropped them there and turned around to fly home. And there was an aircraft in front of me. And just as we were about to cross the coast, we noticed a flak gun, a lot of concentrated flak in a certain place down on the ground. And there was a huge haystack there. They were trying to conceal themselves with this. And he was trying to pick us off as we went. He had a good range for us, the way we were going. Obviously knew exactly where we were, and at any rate, the aircraft in front of me was hit and set on fire, and it was hit in the wing, and just coming over the water by then, and he seemed to climb away. We were only at about 800 feet or something like that. I'm not sure how high we were, but we were fairly low, and I think he tried to climb away to bail the crew out, possibly, or maybe to come back over land and bail them out. And but the wing was on fire, and all of a sudden the wing just folded up and fell off, and the aircraft, of course, then just catapulted over and plunged into the water, and I didn't see anybody get out of it at all. And as you say, as you've often mentioned, how did you feel? I felt, I can remember saying to myself, poor bastards, and you know, and I was fortunate enough they didn't have time to re-aim their gun before I got over the thing without getting hit. And so, but it made me think about what to do in a situation like that, and I wondered whether he would have had time to crash land the aircraft before the wing fell off. But of course he didn't know the wing was going to fall off. He must have been hit in the main spar, I think. But it did influence a decision of mine later on, as I'll tell you about later on. And so we went back to base. Oh, we took the position of this gun, and I suppose a lot of other blokes did too. And the navigator marked it on his chart. And of course, when we got back to base and went to debriefing, we gave the intelligence officers the position of this gun.
Ron talks of a gun being positioned in a church steeple or something like that.
Yes, well, of course, Ron and I weren't exactly in the same place at the same time, so he may have done that too, yes. But the one I saw appeared to be in a haystack, and there were probably plenty of them around, you know, but this particular one was the one that drew my attention, particularly when I saw the aircraft hit it in front. And yes, well, there might have been, there was probably other flak guns around. There was concentrated flak, but there were spaces between them. And so we toddled off home, as I said, and landed and told these intelligence officers where this was, and I imagine other crews reported it too. And the next time we were over there on a resupply, that'll be a Rob Roy, the haystack was just a charred mess, and I heard on the grapevine that they'd sent over some rocket firing Typhoons, and they'd got rid of it. So that was good as far as we were concerned. Yes.
So you mentioned taking these gliders over, and obviously in daylight. What was the view when you could see that the gliders were let loose?
Well, it was much like an exercise. That was the point, I think. We'd seen it before in exercises, but this, of course, was the real thing. But, the gliders, as I've said before, when the gliders let loose, they usually rose up a bit and they glided across your path. So there were gliders going down everywhere, and Stirlings everywhere, and there were probably Halifaxes as well. I think there were Halifaxes there too. So there were aeroplanes everywhere. We had become a bit used to seeing this sort of thing on our exercises, because they were pretty massive exercises we did with the airborne troops.
Presumably one of the risks was that a glider was going to glide into a bomber, into a Stirling,
well,
or vice versa.
Yes, well, that could have happened. I don't know. I'm not aware that it did.
How did the team work in that situation? Here you are, you've got gliders gliding in front of you, behind you, and underneath and on top.
You just tried to keep your distance and release your glider over the dropping zone. That's all you did. And of course, everybody was trying to keep away from each other. So it was just typical of a big raid. At night you couldn't even see the other aircraft, but they were there just the same. And I imagine there'd be quite a few air-to-air collisions, but I didn't have one. The only near thing I had was that one I mentioned at advanced flying. When the aircraft went that close, I heard the noise and saw the shadow on the windscreen. But with that actual operations, I didn't come that close to any other aircraft. So where am I now?
Well, you've just let the glider go. What do you do next? I mean, you sort of, okay, here we go, off home, do a backflip.
Yes, well, you go back as
do you have to maintain a certain height, a certain level, once you've let a glider go, or can you basically just sort of free-for-all?
Oh, no, it's more or less a free-for-all. We were all given a height to go, and we were all trying to keep at that height. So you'd still been the same. You just had to use your vision to make sure you didn't collide with anybody, and bank around and go back home, set course for home. As usual, when the gliders went, they left their tow rope with us, so we had to drop that, and there was a special place you had to go and drop that. That's probably why we were lower now, I think about it. We had to go down and drop these tow ropes. They were 300 feet long and 3 inches in diameter, and great big steel couplings on both ends. So they were nasty businesses if you dropped them anywhere where there were people. So we had to get rid of those, and then that's the reason we were low when we crossed the coast, I guess. Yes, because I'm not sure what height we dropped the gliders from, but it would have been a couple of thousand feet or something, probably, to give them a chance to see where they were going. But I don't remember the exact height we dropped them. So then I got into if I flew too fast, then when they were winding those in, the crew used to growl because it was very hard work. At any rate, we got back to base okay.
What were people saying about that particular experience, the sights you'd seen, the experiences that you'd had? What were you talking about?
Well, by the time we got back, it was almost it was evening, I suppose, so we didn't sort of get together much. Most of us had a meal and went to bed, but I know we were all very relieved. We heard on the radios that the invasion was going well at that time, and I think I felt a feeling of great satisfaction, in as much as 38 group and 46 group. 46 group was a general transport group, and they joined us on that occasion, and I don't know whether they were towing gliders or what they were doing, but they were probably dropping troops and that too. We'd dropped the whole 6th Airborne Division into Normandy by the evening. And so we were very pleased about that, not without casualties and so forth. I did hear that we lost 16, or the RAF lost 16 aircraft on that Mallard operation. I only read that since the war, of course, but and I don't recall how many we lost that night, that day.
Well, people talk of you know, okay, you go to the bar and you debrief yourself with a stiff brandy or something.
Well, they used to give us a rum if we wanted it. But I can remember having a rum, but that was after the event was over. It wasn't rum for before the event, because we didn't drink any alcohol before we were flying. Mm. Never. Well, I can't speak for everybody, but certainly, so far as I'm aware, we never ever drank anything after the night before, at least, and also we didn't smoke on the aircraft.